Today we're going to be hearing the case, and the name of this case is called John Hickenlooper versus the Freedom From Religion Foundation. This case has been set for 1 hour. That means that each side has a half an hour to argue, and they'll have to be responsible for their own time. I'll have you just simply introduce yourself when you get to the microphone, if you will, and let's make sure that you can be heard, if you don't mind. So whenever the petitioners are ready, then, on behalf of Governor Hickenlooper, please. Counsel?
May it please the court, Michael Francisco, here for Governor Hickenlooper and the state of Colorado. With me at council table is Matthew Grove. Every year, Colorado's governor issues approximately 300 honorary proclamations on topics as diverse as Chili Appreciation Society International Day, perhaps better known Denver Broncos Mania Day, or Drinking Water Week. This case comes before the court because a handful of Colorado citizens don't like a particular proclamation that speaks of prayer. The plaintiffs here, no matter how offended by this instance of the governor speaking, simply lack standing. And even if they had standing, these ephemeral and benign proclamations fail to give a preference by law to a denomination or mode of worship. The wall of separation between church and state stands firm regardless of what the governor may choose to say about prayer. The court of below erred to find that there was taxpayer standing for these plaintiffs for a number of reasons. This court has never extended the taxpayer standing doctrine to cases where there was not an expenditure of public funds. And here, the court found that government overhead and not an expenditure of public funds provided a basis for the plaintiffs to challenge the government's proclamations with their status as taxpayers. If that were the rule in Colorado, taxpayer standing would go well beyond where it has gone in previous cases, and this court would have to sit to hear complaints from virtually anybody to challenge any form of government action that they believe violates the Constitution. That's never been the law in Colorado, and we contend that it would be an inappropriate rule for this court to adopt. Indeed, the doctrine of taxpayer standing has been looked at 4 times by this court since Dodge, and in each case, the court spoke of an expenditure of public funds. There have been general statements in this court's own precedent that speak of a citizen's interest in the state conforming to the Constitution. That, however, has never been the end of the analysis, and that's where the mistake was below. The court took a general statement of standing and simply didn't do the additional analysis that's required for a plaintiff to establish taxpayer standing. Without that additional analysis, taxpayer standing becomes a different doctrine that bears no relationship to the taxpayer as a taxpayer.
Well, under that Wimberley standard that we've often followed, if there's a specialized interest, an injury in fact, that can confer standing, can it not? And here, if one particular religion is being advanced over others by this proclamation, why doesn't someone who doesn't belong to that religion and want to uphold the First Amendment and actually takes offense at the state sponsoring a proclamation like this, why wouldn't they have standing?
Well, Your Honor, the Wimberley case addresses the general citizen standing where somebody has a particular individualized injury. The Court of Appeals didn't reach individual standing in this case, where we do believe that the plaintiffs have failed to establish individual standing, as we've argued below. The reason they don't have individualized standing is simply the facts of this case don't support that they have enough direct and unwelcome contact with the proclamation. Being offended by certain government actions in the context of the Establishment Clause or the Preference Clause has indeed in many cases given rise to that individualized injury, but not when the exposure to that government action simply came through the media. And that is what you have in this case. The plaintiffs have only alleged below that they learned of these proclamations through the media. This is not like the Ten Commandments in Lincoln Park where somebody would walk by them to get to their work, or in other cases where there are commandments in a courthouse and the allegations would be that an individual has to go to the courthouse, or students in a school who are compelled to be there by law and they become in contact with the government action in that context. Here, they simply learned about them in the media, and that's expressly what the U.S. Supreme Court rejected in Valley Forge when it said that merely learning of a government action through the media is not enough to give you an individualized injury. So we think under that analysis, as apart from the taxpayer analysis, these plaintiffs simply haven't provided the type of factual basis that would show a direct and unwelcome contact with these proclamations.
Counsel, how would such an injury be shown, though, with a proclamation? I understand you're saying you could have, you're walking by the Ten Commandments every day or whatever, but that really isn't applicable here, is it, with a proclamation? I mean, is it just, could there never be an injury?
Your Honor, there's probably a reason that no court in the country has reached this type of proclamation on an individualized standing analysis, and it's because these are, as we say, ephemeral. They're not a monument and a park. They're not the type of government action that you would typically come in contact with. But yes, we do believe there could be scenarios where somebody would have enough direct contact, but it would require something more than what you have in this case. As we say, if the governor were to mail these proclamations to a set of individuals or to every individual, that perhaps would give them enough contact. Or if the governor were to issue a proclamation and then take an additional action and say, by the way, I will only accept applications for employment if you agree with my proclamation, that would begin to give somebody the type of direct and unwelcome contact, but you simply don't have that in this case. We would say the general situation, typically, these proclamations, honorary proclamations in particular, where the governor's office doesn't go out there and use them for any legal purpose, you would not create the type of individualized injury that you would need under the Wimberly test.
Well, aren't these proclamations used by the organizers of the event to widely publicize this gathering and to promote the religious content of these proclamations? Certainly, getting elected officials there, inviting them, encouraging them to be there, to turn out local and state governmental support for prayer. Isn't that exactly what this proclamation is trying to do? Organize a sort of a movement that's widely publicized and then sponsored by government through this official proclamation?
Your Honor, how the private individuals choose to use this proclamation is really separate from what would create an injury under the Establishment Clause context. If what individuals do with these types of actions would be enough, then this court would have to hear cases where the governor issues a call for citizens to pray for victims of a tragedy, or perhaps he issues a brief statement of prayer at the end of a State of the State address, that would then be enough of an injury to have this court be required to reach the merits on whether something violates the preference clause. So how the proclamations are used by other individuals is really apart from the standing analysis. But more importantly, in this case, there is not evidence that these individuals came in direct and unwelcome contact. In fact, what the record shows is they admitted they were not permitted from exercising their right to non-belief, and they were not coerced. They admitted that they did not attend any of these prayer events, and they admitted that they were not encouraged to attend an event, and there was no consequences for them not attending an event. So whether or not other Colorado citizens did indeed gather on a day of prayer is really quite apart from it. And also interesting, in this case, these prayer gatherings are likely to continue regardless of the outcome of this case because there's a federal statute that sets the first Thursday in May as the day of prayer. And so it's not just the governor's proclamation that gives rise to these events. These are individuals exercising their constitutional rights to gather and pray, which have really never been in question.
But they could go ahead and do that without the governor's imprimatur on a proclamation, right? So why are they seeking the governor's stamp of approval, if you will?
They, like many other groups and causes, find it helpful to have these sorts of proclamations. There's reasons that these are issued almost every day of the year by the governor, and certainly they could continue without it. But If this court were to tell the governor that he cannot issue prayer proclamations, it would be a situation which we've never had under the preference clause or the establishment clause, where speaking, the governor in this case, merely speaking about religion, is treated with special disfavor. Because in essence, you would be saying the governor can issue proclamations about everything from sports to certain causes to even recognizing individuals, which is what he does through these broad proclamations. But you just can't speak about religion. And that would be contrary to this court's admonishment in the last case under the preference clause, Freedom from Religion Foundation versus Colorado, where it said that the Constitution doesn't require complete separation of church and state. It affirmatively mandates accommodation, not merely tolerance of all religions, and forbids hostility towards any. And we believe a rule that said the governor can speak about anything but prayer would be contrary to that principle of neutrality, which is what the preference clause has been interpreted by this court to mean.
The Court of Appeals here found taxpayer standing expressly. Is that not right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you, the way you started off, it seemed your argument was at least directed, seems a kind of a de minimis argument, or at least one that taxpayer standing shouldn't prevail. You shouldn't have taxpayer standing if all that's involved is overhead costs, the payment of officials involved. I guess where I'd like to go with that is you seem to admit, concede on the side as you began, that we have rather broad language, if not exactly cases that have been applied that have carried the taxpayer standing that far. But we do seem to have very broad language about almost universal taxpayer standing. How would you like us to draw a line there and decide when a taxpayer really should have standing?
Your Honor, we have several suggested lines that this court could draw. While we do acknowledge that there's been some broad language in the cases, as indeed has been pointed out by special concurrence in the last and the first taxpayer standing case this court issued, all of the cases that have come before this court have involved a, quote, expenditure of public funds, end quote. And we believe that the expenditure of public funds language that this court has already used in its cases should be understood to mean something more than mere government overhead. That's not the type of expenditure of public funds that has a connection to the claim that it violates the preference clause. The discussion in Hine, we absolutely think, provides a good, clear rule that this court could look to adopt, that you have to have a specific expenditure by the General Assembly, in this case, of funds, to have a taxpayer standing challenge. Either of those lines would work. The idea here is that it has to be a direct expenditure, something that's redressable. It can't just be government activity. Otherwise, we're not talking about taxpayers. We're simply talking about the government.
You seem to slide into that by the legislature, directly by the legislature. So do you mean, even apart from salaries or what one might call overhead, if the funds came from money that had been appropriated for more general purposes to the executive, for instance, and the executive made an expenditure for this kind of a thing, that would not qualify for taxpayer standing?
Your Honor, it needs to be a specific identifiable expenditure. It's always the case that government salaries are involved when you're speaking of challenging government action. Otherwise, the Brotman case that this court issued would have been wrongly decided. This court said there was not taxpayer standing in this case because the funds, and they were real money at issue, involved the school land trust, not general tax dollars. Well, it certainly would have been true that individuals in the Department of Education and the state employees that administer those funds have a salary, just like Governor Hickenlooper and just like his security staff. So it has to be something specifically related to the taxpayer. That's the concept of nexus that the FLAS decision of the U.S. Supreme Court spoke of, and is indeed what this court relied upon in FLAS if you go back to the Dodge decision. So there's always been this concept of taxpayer standing is connected to the taxpayer. There's an interest in not having the government, under the federal rule, use your tax dollars, even a fractional amount, for something that violates the Establishment Clause. It has to be something other than general overhead. Otherwise, there's no limit to the doctrine. Somebody could challenge the governor when he attends church, but he takes a security detail with him, which we believe would be a common occurrence, or when he appears on the national press after a tragedy, as Governor Hickenlooper has done from time to time, and he calls on citizens to pray for, in that case, Claire Davis, the victim of the Arapahoe school shooting. That's also using staff time, the governor's salary, in the same way that the Court of Appeals found in this case. So the limit to the doctrine has to weed out general government overhead. There's a discussion in Hine that's helpful, which distinguishes between these sorts of specific expenditures and the general appropriations, because it is trivially true that, yes, the governor's salary is paid, and in that sense, anytime the government is acting as governor, you could say that there's an appropriation of tax money, but it has to be more direct.
Did your reference to our reference to FLAST mean to suggest that we've limited taxpayer standing in the same way the federal government has in FLAST?
Yes and no, Your Honor. This court has looked at FLAST as requiring that there's a nexus to the taxpayer. We believe that's what the Dodge case should be understood to support when it quotes the nexus language in FLAST. As we pointed out in the briefs, this court has also used general statements of standing which are related to the injury requirement, saying that individuals have an interest in the government conforming to the Constitution. But that has never been the end of the inquiry. So in that sense, we do believe this court's precedent supports following the federal precedent, FLAST and Hine, and requiring taxpayer standing to have to be a specific expenditure of the legislature. Now, as this court knows, the federal cases have only extended taxpayer standing to the Establishment Clause, not to other provisions of the federal Constitution. This court has not adopted that second limit of FLAST, and we're not asking that the court review that at this time, particularly because this is a preference clause case. So that aspect of federal taxpayer standing is simply not before the court at this time.
Could you move on to the second issue, if you wouldn't mind, please, which is whether or not the governor even has the constitutional authority to issue such proclamations?
Yes, Your Honor. We contend that this court can look first to the plain language of the preference clause, which says that nor shall any preference be given by law to any religious denomination or mode of worship. And if you look at even the plain language before getting into the precedent, which we also believe support this position, you see that these honoring proclamations don't even rise to the level of being a law. They don't have the force of law. If you disagree with the governor's proclamation, as perhaps people who aren't Broncos fans do, nothing happens. A good example of this, in that proclamation where the governor proclaimed Broncos Mania Day, he proclaimed to rename the 5314ers for the players. So Mount Elbert was named Mount Peyton Manning, and Long's Peak was named Matt Prater Mountain.
That's a form of religion in our state, isn't it?
It may well be a form of religion. We would not disagree with that proposition.
But the point is that is a secular purpose. You know, a sports team, athletic event. It's clearly understood that's secular, but these proclamations, let me read you this one whereas clause that I think is the punchline of this whole issue about whether there is a preference being given here to religion. Whereas across our land on May 6, Americans will unite and pray for a prayer for our nation, our state, our leaders, and our people. Americans. So those who aren't Americans, those who don't choose to pray are not Americans. There's some kind of a urging here or a preference for characterizing America as a land where religion is practiced, and somehow those who don't practice it are not Americans. Isn't that the import of this? There isn't any choice in here recognizing that you don't have to be a believer and still be an American. The First Amendment is the First Amendment for a reason. It protects the right not to believe as well as the right to believe. So when you look at the content of this proclamation, isn't it saying that we Americans are this religious nation? And more than that, I believe when you look at it, we are a particular religion within this nation, the Christian nation. Now, isn't that the import of what the organizers are trying to promote here with this effort?
No, Your Honor. And under Establishment Clause precedent, courts have never taken a mere acknowledgement of religion to be enough to say that you are establishing a church or you're preferencing religion. If you go to that limit analysis under the federal precedent, the courts are very clear. It's an objective inquiry, and you have to look at the overall context. Indeed, the Ten Commandments still stand across from the courthouse in Lincoln Park, and it certainly includes religious statements if you go and read the Ten Commandments about God. And the same sorts of inferences that Your Honor was just giving could be made by somebody who only went and read that monument. But the point of these cases is always you have to understand it in the context of where it is. With monuments, that typically means the surrounding area. The whole Capitol grounds is what this court looked at in that case. And here, you have to look at the other 300 proclamations. You can't just look at this particular proclamation, because the reality is the governor issues many proclamations on all sorts of topics. And so the reasonable observer would not feel that they're being excluded or that this is an announcement of religion by the governor.
Well, the proclamations are not issued simultaneously, right? They're issued one at a time. And so how does that work? How is it like Lincoln Park with the Ten Commandments, or like the crash case, the nativity scene case, where you have secular things that are on display with things that have more of a religious theme? That juxtaposition doesn't exist here, does it?
I would say two things, Your Honor. We think the context has to include the other proclamations, as the district court looked at and as other courts have looked at when they review proclamations. Otherwise, if you just look at the religious acknowledgement itself, everything would fail the endorsement analysis if the context were always narrowed to just the religious statement. Justice O'Connor reviews that in the Lynch case. Secondly, and we don't want this to be lost, these proclamations are simply not the sort of government activity that raises the type of concern under the Establishment or Preference Clause that these other cases look at. Indeed, Justice Souter said that proclamations are rarely noticed, ignored without effort, and conveyed over impersonal medium. And Justice Stevens, typically very vigorous in enforcing the Establishment Clause, said that they undoubtedly seem official, but in most circumstances they don't constitute the sort of governmental endorsement of religion which the separation of church and state is aimed at preventing. So both the type of speech here, which is really what we have, this is a capital P proclamation, but it might as well be a lowercase p proclamation. Indeed, the record reflects one of the governors went and spoke at a prayer event. So would this court tell a governor that he cannot talk about religion in his actual speech? Now, these plaintiffs don't ask for that remedy, but the logic of the Court of Appeals decision and the nature of their injury has no limit. There's no reason that they wouldn't feel equally as personally offended when the governor, in fact, speaks about religion, and wouldn't have the same sort of preference clause claim that they do with these proclamations. Indeed, this case is on the outer bounds of Establishment Clause or Preference Clause cases. No court has found this sort of honorary proclamation, or even a formal prayer proclamation, which we believe the record reflects as being more overtly religious than the proclamations in the record, as violating the Establishment Clause or the Preference Clause.
Could I ask you a question about the two clauses? This issue was brought specifically under the Colorado Constitution. Do you see any difference between the way what we're calling the Preference Clause, the Colorado additional language, should be construed with regard to entitlement problems from the way the First Amendment's construed?
We do, Your Honor, and we look at this court's opinion in the Americans United case in 1982, and it says that the court will look to the plain text and purpose of the provision first. There's considerably more specific language in the clause. However, it went on, and other courts have followed it, to find the federal cases persuasive and helpful because they embody the same values of keeping an established religion from coming from the government. So we believe that under the plain text analysis, this court could look at, say, the word preference and how it's been used in the other part of the Colorado Constitution and apply that to say that this case easily satisfies the preference clause. But even under the March analysis, which is certainly applicable and is the closest factual analogy to this case, or under the Lemon analysis, the proclamations do survive. Indeed, there are three...
To follow up on Justice Coates' question, though, our cases have not actually construed the phrases that you're picking up on, preference and by law, in a way that's different than General Establishment Clause jurisprudence. We have essentially treated them identically, have we not?
this court...
Despite the passage you've mentioned from Americans United?
Well, yes, Your Honor, there's only a handful of cases, and this court, for example, in the Kresh case in Conrad, found it persuasive to look to a Kresh case at the federal level. Likewise, the Ten Commandments case in the Park, it looked at the federal analog. So we certainly believe the court has the prerogative and ability to look at the text separately. It could do that here, and even if it doesn't, the precedent all still shows that this is not creating an establishment of religion. Indeed, there are three important cases that are relevant here that have all involved the Freedom from Religion Foundation itself. Both the Freedom from Religion Foundation in the Ten Commandments case in Colorado, in the Hine case at the Supreme Court, and in the Seventh Circuit challenging the same sorts of prayer proclamations here. It's interesting to note that in all of these cases, the Freedom from Religion Foundation's rather extreme views that religious references have to be purged from public life have all been rejected, and they haven't even been addressed by the brief of the Freedom from Religion Foundation, because these views have not been adopted by other courts. And I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
You may do so.
May it please the court. My name is Rich Bolton. I'm with the Boardman Clark Law Firm in Madison, Wisconsin. With me at council table is Dan Bonifazi from the Bonifazi and Indewish Law Firm. And I've lost track of him. One of the named plaintiffs, Mike Smith, is here in person. There he is. I get an overriding impression from the governor's argument, and that is that what's at issue here isn't very important. I'm told that these types of proclamations, a proclamation issued with the executive seal, a proclamation declaring a day of prayer for the state of Colorado, a proclamation issued by the governor in its official capacity, we're told that these are the types of things that, in a sense, we shouldn't get too worked up about, that this is simply an offense by people who perhaps they think take offense too easily. It's not like, and this is kind of ironic, it's not like, we recognize that there are certainly circumstances in which a crutch at a local courthouse or a school or a local government office building would in fact be prohibited. But what we're told is that's in a different category than something in which the governor proclaims for the entire state that there shall be a day of prayer and endorses a particular event for a particularly evangelical group. That this is not as important as the local type of government speech endorsing religion that the courts have prohibited. And that goes to part of the standing issue as well. A recognition, an attempt to limit standing in a way that in many respects it gives basically the council says there's no pedestrian aspect here, there's no direct contact where you have to walk by the crash or the monument, that we're really only concerned with government speech where there's a pedestrian aspect to it.
Well, Greg, let me ask you this now. The organization that's your client, Freedom from Religion, has a particular view that the First Amendment allows you, as an American, not to have to believe in a religion. Now, what if your group asked the governor for a Freedom from Religion Day, and he were willing to do that? I don't know that you've ever asked him that, but the creche, the Christmas display that was upheld on the city and county of Denver steps, was viewed kind of as cultural, historical, a wide diversity of things there, Santa Claus, the manger, all kinds of parts of our cultural life. Now, why aren't these proclamations the same kind of thing? Any group can come in And apparently the governor likes to recognize these things, you know? If you can do a chili cook-off, certainly you could do a freedom from religion proclamation. So why not? Isn't that the answer to it, that the governor honors all of these, and anybody that wants to do an event that's important to them, they have the ability to do that. You have the freedom not to practice a religion, to proclaim your First Amendment right there. So why isn't this just an equal opportunity that's not taken advantage of by your group, and you're just asking that some other group not be able to do it?
Well, the suggestion that that all speech by the government is implicated under the Constitution in the same way is not true. The Colorado Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently recognized that government speech endorsing religion is different than private speech, and that, and so, for instance, the governor, they point to a variety of endorsements, because this is what they are, that some of them seem quite foolish. But the fact of the matter is that they're not all prohibited by the Constitution. One of the founders, one of the principals of the Freedom from Religion Foundation was asked in a deposition one time basically this question. Well, there are lots of proclamations and recognized days that some have become controversial. And he gave the example, he said, what about Columbus Day? Columbus Day has become controversial in some circles now. He says, are you offended by that? And you haven't sued on that? And the response that she gave was, Annie Laurie Gaylor, the president of the foundation, the answer that she gave, I thought, was very spot on. She said, our foundation is interested in upholding the constitutional restrictions and parameters. And so whether or not Columbus Day or some other recognized day is good or bad, it may not be unconstitutional. The Constitution does, in fact, have restrictions on government speech endorsing religion. And that's what distinguishes these endorsements from others. And the notion that, well, there's a whole bunch of them, so shouldn't we review each of these, shouldn't the Day of Prayer proclamation be viewed as part of a collective group of proclamations? The fact of the matter is, though, that these proclamations are issued as standalone documents, as standalone proclamations. And so let me give you an example. And where this argument that we should take a broad perspective and say, if we look at all of the government speech, then it looks like this is just a small part of it. In the area of taxes, in the Texas Monthly case, one of the arguments where there was a special tax exemption for sales of religious publications, and the argument was, well, but if we look at all the entire tax code, there are tax benefits for other groups as well, and so this isn't really a specialized benefit because you've got another tax deduction here for corporations and this and that, and the court said you can't look at that broader perspective, and you can't look at the entire ambit of government speech and then conclude that this isn't an endorsement of religion, because in the context of all of the speech, it doesn't stand out. The fact of the matter is that these are standalone proclamations. These proclamations don't reference other proclamations. These proclamations are not issued in a bundle. These are standalone proclamations, and they are intended. They are solicited, and they are intended for the purpose of endorsing and promoting that particular event.
I'm sorry, to follow up on Justice Hobbs' question, and I think that his question about whether your group or another group could come in and ask the governor to issue a proclamation on National Atheism Day or National Freedom from Religion, or Colorado Freedom from Religion Day, goes to whether it's truly perceived as an endorsement. If in your view, they are endorsements, and on the one hand, the state is in your view, endorsing religion by these proclamations, would it not at the same time be endorsing atheism, perhaps, through an acknowledgement going the other direction? I'm trying to understand and reconcile the distinction.
Well, the no preference clause does not prohibit endorsements of any and all ilk. And so when you say, aren't these other proclamations in some fashion endorsements as well? I think they are. And you say, well, then what distinguishes those endorsements from this particular endorsement? And what distinguishes it is that because it is a governmental endorsement.
But if the government at the same time or a week later endorsed atheism, can you say on balance that it has preferred religion over non-religion? I'm struggling to see the distinction. Again, this really goes to the perceived effect and whether this is truly an exhortation.
I think you have to look at the endorsement.
So what language in the proclamation makes this an exhortation or a true endorsement as opposed to simply an acknowledgement that an event is taking place?
I think you have to read these proclamations. And you read them in the context of there's a declared day of prayer. That's what's happening here. And then there's the perambulatory language. And it is known that this is not just a government notice posting. These are requested by a specific group to endorse a particular event. If one of the things I tell people, a lot of people, you know, when they disparage lawyers, I always say, you know, whatever makes sense, I should just assume that the law says something different. And I tell them that's not the case. In my experience, what seems to make sense is generally pretty close to what the law says as well. And the reason I make that point is that if you went, the notion that these proclamations, as Justice indicated, noting that good Americans are praying, and that, you know, I commend this to you, and that we're going to have a designated day of prayer, and then this are. These endorsements are then utilized as references, as credibility and prestige gatherers by the National Day of Prayer Task Force. In this circumstance, if you asked the ordinary citizen, do you think the government is endorsing this particular event and this concept of prayer, people would say, well, of course. That's what it is. And so the notion that this is simply an acknowledgement of a historical role of religion in
an acknowledgement of an event taking place on a given day.
Okay. But just as, for instance, it is not the business of the government, of the state of Colorado and the governor of Colorado, to be endorsing particular religious events. Now you can say, but that doesn't seem fair that the governor could endorse other non-religious events. Now whether or not that's a good use of his time or not is a different question. The fact of the matter is, though, is that we have put prohibitions on the government involvement in religion and the promotion of religion. And so can the governor promote a particular church or all churches or whatnot? The answer is no. But that isn't hostility to, if that's hostility to religion, then the religion clauses of the Colorado Constitution and the U.S. Constitution become, in a sense, unconstitutional because the protections of the religion clauses are then turned around and they say, they evince, you know, to the extent that you limit government speech endorsing religion and you don't limit government speech endorsing other subjects, then you're showing hostility to religion. But it becomes perverse then, because the adhering to the religion clauses of the Constitution then is argued as showing hostility, and that it becomes the argument then that the religion clauses actually require an equal amount, or at least a balanced amount of government speech endorsing religion. And it is not the case that either the Colorado Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court, one of the most U.S. Supreme Court decisions, the Suman decision, specifically said government speech remains and is different than private speech, and government speech is subject to the Establishment Clause. There are restrictions on it, and there are good reasons for that. The religion clauses of the Colorado Constitution, which I believe are more protective than the Establishment Clause, but the Establishment Clauses certainly as well, has created this situation in which the government is prohibited from endorsing and promoting religion. And this has proven to be a very history has proven the wisdom of that separation.
Well, at the same time, though, the U.S. Supreme Court cases address situations where, since the founding of the Republic, prayer has been used by President. Gettysburg Address has a very spiritual, religious kind of import to it. The Kennedy assassination, there was lots of public officials praying for President Kennedy and his family. The Columbine example we just heard. I mean, what are the boundaries of what you're urging us to do here?
Well, I'm not necessarily defining the boundaries in the sense that I think what the Court of Appeals did is fully, I don't think it's at the outer edges of what this court has previously held. So in terms of where the edges are, and I will answer your question, but I don't think this is a case that is on the penumbra of is this an endorsement or not. I think it's to conclude that this isn't an endorsement almost defies a reasonable reading and understanding of what's going on here. But in terms of the government, the Supreme Court's acknowledgement, and this court's acknowledgement as well, certainly it's not the case that the religion clauses require do anything. And on the contrary, the religion clauses strictly protect free exercise rights. So it's not like the Constitution is hostile to religion. And certainly acknowledging that religion has been part of our cultural or heritage, there's nothing wrong with that.
I want to follow up on Justice Hobbs' question. I recognize you're not necessarily trying to establish the boundaries, but somewhere in this opinion we need to figure out where those contours are, even if we agree with your views about the merits. We still need to understand and define who gets in the door, who gets to make this claim, and I am in particular interested in whether you view there to be any distinction at all between standing as a citizen versus standing as a taxpayer, because if you do see a distinction, I'm not perceiving it.
You know what?
What is it about being a taxpayer that makes any difference under your view?
Yeah. Let me. I actually agree with you that in this case, the distinction between taxpayer versus citizen standing is in my opinion, not particularly pertinent, because I think under either test, they're standing here. The district court, the trial court, found that there was citizen standing, and there's very little. The governor has very little response to that. The Court of Appeals, in their analysis, I mean, they found that there's a legally protected interest recognized by the religion clauses, and that these people, that the plaintiffs had exposure and unavoidable exposure to these proclamations. And so certainly the Court of Appeals decision covered the basis that the district court had also found. And so I think the court could have very easily just stopped at that point and said, there's at least citizen standing here. But the court went on, and in my opinion, went beyond what was necessary and also concluded that there was taxpayer standing here. And I think, and I want to speak to the governor's argument about what taxpayer standing requires, because I think the Court of Appeals is being unfairly maligned in its analysis of the taxpayer standing issue here. Basically, what the Court of Appeals said is that basically used a use test. Our government resources, are the resources of government being used to promote religion? Now, what the governor says is that, but there's no line item. There's not a check to a vendor that was written, and that is what. So what the governor is essentially saying is that there has to be a line item, or that that somehow you have to be able to unbundle the use of government resources. That you have to be able to unbundle it, and I think that is an unreasonable and a very dangerous test, even for taxpayer standing. Let me give you an example, and I apologize. I speak somewhat as an outsider here, but although I suspect that the Colorado laws are very similar, in Wisconsin, a big issue that comes up periodically is legislators will get in trouble because their staff are using time and office resources, including computer time, for what are considered to be politicking activities, which they're not supposed to do on the clock. Now, the reason that's not considered good is because basically there's an advantage that's being accomplished here, that basically the legislator is being able to use government resources to help retain his or her position, and so basically the notion that and that's recognized as real, even though there's not a line item, even though you can't unbundle that type of use, it's still happening. It is still the use of government resources. And I think that's really what the Court of Appeals concluded here, is that the resources of the office the technical, the technology, the time involved in it is being used. And the fact that you can't unbundle it is asking, it's denying what everybody really knows. If you're working on something that's not government work, if you're working on something that the government's not supposed to do, and you're on the clock, that is the use of government resources, whether you can unbundle it or not. And it would be a dangerous precedent to say that the governor or an administrative agency or a legislator can do whatever they want, even in terms of promoting religion, and they can do it on the clock as long as they're smart enough not to write a specific check to a vendor or to somehow have the employee keep track of his time. As long as you merge it all together, then it's going to be okay. And the Court of Appeals, I think, recognized that that's not what we're looking at with regard to even the taxpayer standing. The question, the issue is use. And the governor's lawyer acknowledged that it's use, but he said it's got to be a specific kind of use. It's got to be use that is identified with a vendor account statement.
Well, could I interrupt? Because
yes.
I want to follow up on Justice Marquez. So basically what you're saying is that if you live in a state where there's a government and the government doesn't do something, does something that you don't like, you're in that state, you can sue.
That's not what I'm saying. If there's a legally, for instance, here, the linchpin was that there's an allegation. The allegation is that there's a constitutional violation here, and that the courts are have been historically very integral in enforcing constitutional rights, particularly. So the notion that I don't like, for instance, let's say.
Well, let me just ask you.
Sure.
Let's do it this way. What has to happen before you can sue? What does the government have to do before you can sue?
Well.
You live in the state. What do they have to do before you can sue?
Okay. I think there are a number of things. If you live in the state, I mean, there are a number of different. For instance.
What are they?
Well. One, and this is a type of, it's not an issue here, you have what I call distributive or regulatory type government action, mm-hmm. where either you're giving money or you're regulating or you're not giving money. That would be one. Number two, you have the type of government speech issue, which is very much involved here. And the notion that that there has to be some contact with it is satisfied in this case, and the notion that the fact that, you know, if the government speech is communicated in a way that in modern, you know, given the technology, basically the government says the more people you can reach, the less likely we can stop it. Only if it's in front of, you know, the.
Well, if you send out an email, the governor, you send out an email. Anybody who doesn't like that email can sue because they hit the button.
Well, I think it depends on who it goes to, quite frankly.
No, the proclamation doesn't go to anybody in particular.
Well, these proclamations are intended. I mean, a proclamation isn't intended as a hip pocket, thank you note. These proclamations are issued, they are known, that they are going to be broadly brought. The intent of a proclamation is to make it known. And in this case, these proclamations were made known. And they are known. And it's not reasonable to say that if the governor issues a proclamation that is intended to and will be made known and broadcast, and in fact, the whole notion of it is that I'm declaring a day of prayer for the entire state. The suggestion then that that the broader the audience, the less likely, the less offense to the Establishment Clause doesn't make sense. These proclamations are issued as, I mean, it's like saying that somebody doesn't have to obey the law. Or pay their taxes some because I didn't specifically get it. There are things that government speakers intend to be broadly disseminated, and this is one of them. And to say that only if there's a pedestrian aspect of it is simply not realistic, and it is open. The government says what we should really be concerned about is when the government does something that's really big in terms of promoting religion. And then he says, so for instance, we should only let people complain if they have to actually walk by it. But if the government issues a big proclamation that is broadly disseminated to everybody and it's intended to declare a day of prayer for the entire state, the bigger the effect, then we're not particularly concerned with it.
Well, I understand, obviously, when we're talking about religion, that it's a very serious issue. And so what I want to do is to try to get at the taxpayer part of it as opposed to the religious part of it. It feels to me like maybe that's why we're having a little trouble, is we'll ask questions about what does the government have to do, and then the answers come back in terms of, well, this is about religion. So let's switch, and let's ask a question about Chile. And let's pretend that Chile was protected. And so what has to happen with respect to this Chile proclamation if you don't like Chile? Do you have to send it out? you have to simply write an email saying, I like Chile, I wish everybody did? Is that government action? I mean, I'm being a little bit pushing the edges.
No, I know.
To try to test your position.
And I'm just not sure I completely understand the question.
So what is the government doing there? That, what gives a taxpayer an opportunity to sue about one's proclamation about Chile? I'm trying to take religion out of it so we can really talk about what the government is doing.
Well, and I think by using Chile, you're basically saying, let's take something, it doesn't really matter, let's not be
That's
concerned
exactly
about
what I'm doing.
Let's not be concerned about the content.
That's it.
So what is it that the government's doing? It is that implicates a taxpayer issue.
Right.
And what the Court of Appeals said, and I think the Court of Appeals correctly assessed this, is that if government resources are being used to issue that proclamation, and whether or not it's a line item or not, our government employees, let's take, because here the government's, a lot of its staff is doing this, is the government staff spending time on this? And if the government staff is spending time on this, just like if the government staff is spending time on real...
I get where you're coming from, and let me ask you, so anything the government does, i.e. the government staff is spending time, so they show up at work, anything they do creates taxpayer standing.
Well,
is that your position?
And again, but that, in terms of the use, I think that's a fair calculation, but that's not the only test. Then there has to be the legally protected interest as well. So, for instance, if I don't like where a road is built or something, there may not be a constitutional issue involved. So, the question that this court
sorry, your time is up.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have any rebuttal argument, Mr. Francisco?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to make two points. The first is that Mr. Bolton's argument about endorsement is founded on a false premise that all proclamations are in some sense endorsements. The error here is that he jumps to the conclusion that comes from two sources. First, he misreads the language of the proclamations themselves. And second, he misunderstands the law of endorsement. As the Supreme Court explained in the Capitol Square case, an endorsement really means favoritism. It does not mean mere acknowledgement. Thus, a demonstration of, quote, approval or support, is the language in the Capitol Square case, is not an endorsement. And the way it's been used in this argument is that approval or support or even a reference to religion would be an endorsement.
And well, isn't it enough that it promotes religion? Isn't it coextensive with the notion of promoting?
A promotion is part of the endorsement analysis, but what the courts have always said is that government actions that reference or speak about religion in themselves are not sufficient to raise the level of promotion. And indeed, if they were, Justice O'Connor's admonition in the Elk Grove case would come true, which is that nearly any government action could be overturned as a violation of the Establishment Clause if a heckler's veto sufficed. And that is what this argument is showing, is that some citizens or individuals do sincerely object to references to religion, and the state certainly does not take issue with those sincere feelings, but that sort of objection is not enough under the Establishment Clause. Secondly, Mr. Bolton asked this court to adopt two holdings, both of which are a change in the law and would adopt a large departure from this court's precedents. The first holding he asks for is that this court not continue with taxpayer standing, but change the doctrine to government resources standing. He used the phrase government resources five or six times.
What is the difference? I mean, try to help us conceptualize. So, you merely come to work, that's not enough. What has to happen more?
You have to have a specific expenditure of public funds, an identifiable use of tax money.
What would be an example?
An example would be the General Assembly passing an appropriation for $100 to the Catholic Church just because they like the Catholic Church. Not a large amount of money, clearly an identifiable, specific appropriation that on standing, not necessarily on the merits, would raise a preference clause issue.
Can I follow up on that? So let's say, as part of the National Day of Prayer, they hosted a, you know, tea and cookies in the Capitol foyer. Would the expenditure for the cookies and lemonade qualify under your test, or does it need to come from the legislature? Can it be an expenditure from the executive branch?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. This court should not follow the NCAA's path about the cost of bagels. It needs to look at what an expenditure is with the General Assembly. That type of an appropriation is exactly what was at issue in Hine.
Right.
There was general appropriation to the executive branch. There's a discretionary decision from the executive to spend that money, and that breaks the link, as the language of Hine, that is really key to showing a nexus to the taxpayer.
Let me blow it up a little bit. Now we have a big party, and we spend $10,000 for a gala in the 48 for celebration of National Prayer Day, but it comes from the executive branch.
We don't believe that would be sufficient, and indeed, that's not as much money as was at issue with the federal Day of Prayer proclamations in the Seventh Circuit. If you look at the lower court decision there, Chief Judge Easterbrook points out that it's likely $500,000 for the executive branch to even attend one of these events. But because it's a general executive branch use of government overhead, there's no specific appropriation, it's inappropriate for taxpayer standing. If it's not, if this court says the government resources is enough, whether it's a $10,000 party or not, then the Brotman decision and the hoteling decision below were both wrongly decided. In both cases, the lower court and this court rejected taxpayer standing, and if government overhead is enough, it is a doctrinal change, and it will have consequences on the scope and the number of cases that this court will face. The second holding...
I don't want to tag team necessarily, but so you're not going so far as to say it has to be a line item, an appropriation in the long bill.
It has to be, it could be a line item. That's not the only, that's not perhaps the best or only test that you could use. The language in Hine is helpful, a specific appropriation. The concept here is similar to redressability. If you can't redress it, then it's not sufficient. The second holding Mr. Bolton asked for that would be a change is that the endorsement test be construed by this court really to be a reference test, that any reference to the divine or religion is itself an endorsement of religion. That's simply inconsistent. Consistent with this court's rulings in State versus Freedom from Religion Foundation or in Conrad. The religious symbols in those cases are certainly every bit of an acknowledgement, the correct legal term we would contend, of religion, as in this case, and indeed more so, a symbol representing the birth of Christ or the first four commandments, as Justice Ginsburg pointed out in the Ten Commandments case, are clearly an acknowledgement of religion. But that's never been enough to show that there's an endorsement of religion, and that's what this court would have to hold to find that this is an endorsement of religion.
Chief, may I ask
yes,
a question?
Yes, you may ask one.
Help me understand why in this context we shouldn't focus more on the intangible nature of the injury and assessing standing. Why do we have to focus solely on appropriations and talk about cookies and lemonade when we're talking about this kind of injury that's maybe not as susceptible to that kind of evaluation?
Well, Your Honor, this case does lead to some confusion because it's both a taxpayer standing and a citizen standing case, as we've briefed. I would point you to the discussion in the Brotman decision as being most helpful, and the court there separately analyzes the Dodge taxpayer standing line, which is what the Court of Appeals solely relied upon and why we've addressed that in detail. And then it went on independently to do the Wimberly analysis of whether there's an individualized injury. And what it is true, we believe that psychic injuries, so-called, can give rise to preference clause or establishment clause standings in certain circumstances, but as we've pointed out, courts have always required something akin to direct and unwelcome contact or a change in behavior, and that is what is entirely lacking in the record on this case, and so why, while there may be strong disagreement or a psychic reaction, psychological reaction to the proclamations, they don't have enough contact with the proclamations to make out that individualized standing. Thank you.
Nobody else? All right. The court wishes to thank both of you, Mr. Francisco and Mr. Bolton. We appreciate your arguments today.